Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Welcome back to Friday Drive Time with old Labour economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Coming up, the privatisation of the National Health Service. Is this the end of civilisation as we know it? A truly frightening investigative report from Spinwatch. And we're also joined by former women's editor at the Western Daily Press, Susie Weldon. And the first part of our series on censorship. We go back to 1987 and the day the lights went out at the BBC. But first, for many people in Bristol, high house prices and lack of mortgage finance mean that owning or renting a decent home is still just a dream. Now, the recently launched Bristol Community Land Trust is offering an alternative route to home ownership or rental by involving the local community as well as future residents in the design and construction of affordable homes.
My name is Jackson Moulding and I'm one of the directors of the Asheville Action Group based in St. Werburgh's in Bristol.
Now, you've got an event taking place at Hamilton House on Stokes Croft next week. Can you tell us when that is and what it's about?
We've been working with a group of people within Bristol and with Bristol City Council to set up a community land trust for Bristol. The event is going to be on the 3rd of February, which is the Thursday, and there's going to be two sessions, one at 3 o'clock and one at 6 o'clock. It'll also be open throughout the day after 3 o'clock. So if someone can't make those times but can drop in at 4 or 5, that'd be fine. The CLT, or the Community Land Trust, is about trying to find a way of addressing housing needs that allows community ownership of housing or other entity that's within that community. So it could be the Community Land Trust can also be around sort of ownership of a pub or a green space or social space or community hub or something like that. But at the moment, Bristol City Council is looking at CLTs as a way of addressing housing need, and that's what the event on Thursday is looking at, how we can move forward with setting one up.
What's the difference between a sort of Georgian or Victorian terrace and a bunch of self-built houses like here at Ashley Vale?
Well, there doesn't actually have to be any different. You can still have a self-build that looks exactly like a Victorian terrace, and that's the beauty of self-build, is that it's been involved in the process. So you can have the self-build that you see on Grand Designs, but it's not all about that. You know, it's not about having these, you know, huge amounts of finance where you create these sort of million-pound homes. It's about having the involvement in the process and the understanding of the process and the knowledge of what you've done, and the sense if you're involved in building, then it can be a route into creating a stronger local community, because if you're building around other people, then, you know, you might be sharing skills or knowledge, or, you know, you've got something heavy to lift and you need a few people to come around and help you do that. And obviously that's if you're doing a project with a number of other people, and you get the benefits of a home without having to pay the high market values up front.
That was Jackson Moulding from the Ashley Vale Action Group, and that's that wonderful group of self-built homes underneath the tunnel at St Werburgh's at Minor Road, if you know it. And if you don't, go on Minor Road under the tunnel and have a look. And that's the kind of thing that they're talking about. The opening event of the Bristol Community Land Trust is next week, 3 to 7pm on Thursday, the 3rd of February, at Hamilton House. That's 80 Stokes Croft. Attendees will be able to browse displays and talk to experts and Bristol Community Land Trust representatives about the potential projects, with short presentations being given both at 3 and 6pm. And as Jackson said, if you can't make 3 or 6pm next Thursday, then just pop along at any time between and you can have a look at the various displays there. Now, Britain's National Health Service has been praised across the world as a model of civilised society. It ensures that if any one of our fellow countrymen and women fall ill, then everyone's wealth is used to help them to the best ability modern medicine can achieve. The NHS was launched on the 5th of July, 1948.
This is the BBC Home Service. The Speaker is Dr. Edith Summerskill, MP, Parliamentary Secretary of the Ministry of Food.
It was the suffering of a woman which finally drew me into the political world. One wet, cold night many years ago, at the age of 22, a newly qualified doctor, I went to attend my first confinement. Very nervous, I arrived with my new black bag. My knock was answered by the young husband, pallid and shabby, with the familiar signs of long unemployment upon him. He took me upstairs to a room stripped of all but the bare necessities of life. There lay the patient on a mattress, covered by a threadbare blanket, a girl of my own age, in labour with her second child. By the bed stood a cot, and standing grasping the wooden bars was a child with bulging forehead and crooked legs, the classic picture of rickets, a disease of undernourishment. The young mother clutched my hand with her own moist, bony fingers, on which she wore a greenish brass wedding ring, twisted round with cotton to prevent it falling off. In that room that night, I became a socialist, and I joined in the fight. Not against a class, but against a system. A system which accepted unemployment as the natural order of things. A system which permitted one-third of the population between the two wars to suffer from some degree of undernourishment. A system which refused to accept responsibility for the welfare of the most helpless among us. The aim my party set itself many years ago was to remove poverty, hunger, and insecurity from the lives of the people. That is what we are seeking to do now that we have been put into power by the people. But to remove poverty and hunger calls for a great effort. It requires a vigorous and positive policy. It means you no longer leave it to chance whether unemployment shall descend upon the country, or where it shall strike, reducing whole families, whole towns to misery. It means that we must plan.
That was Labour MP Dr. Edith Summerskill announcing the new National Health Service on the BBC Home Service, what's now Radio 4. And that was back on the 3rd of April 1948. And I'm joined by former women's editor on the Western Daily Press and health writer Susie Weldon. Hi Susie, welcome.
Hi.
To Drive Time.
Thanks for having me.
Now, how do you think these new changes that Andrew Lansley's bringing into the NHS will actually affect the service?
I'm extremely worried about them. I think that basically they will destroy the NHS as we know it today. I think they will usher in a privatised National Health Service through the back door. And I think that, to be honest with you, I think patients will die in the next few years because we're talking about a massive upheaval to the NHS. The government talks about this as evolution. It is not. It is revolution, as every serious health service commentator and think tank has said. And they're talking about bringing in these changes at dramatic speed. I mean, only a couple of weeks ago, cancer charities warned that patients will die if the government goes ahead and effectively disbands the teams of experts that are now in place. So I'm extremely worried. I think people will suffer, and I think we will end up with a worse health service than we do now, and something that's much more like a kind of... Well, it won't be entirely privatised, but there'll be a lot of private involvement in it, and I'm very worried.
Now, we had on the programme here last week Lib Dem councillor John Rogers, who's in the cabinet on Bristol City Council. He's also a GP himself, and he was saying that actually this is what GPs have been calling for a long time, is much more control about where they commission the service from. So they don't have to always commission it from an NHS clinic. It can be a private clinic if the GP decides that's a good idea.
Well, this is a trend that's been happening in the NHS, there's no doubt about it. And I think most people would agree that GPs should have more control over where they commission services. I don't think we disagree with that necessarily. But I think under the proposals as they exist at the moment, effectively what will happen is by opening the door to private service providers much more than is present, by making GPs, you know, have to tender to competition rules and so on. What's going to happen is that instead of just being able to have a private health service provider providing a bit of an add-on that might benefit patients, what will end up happening is that the few health services that are still public will end up being degraded. For example, it's very expensive to run things like cancer services and accident and emergency. And at the moment, the cost of running a hospital structure which provides all those really expensive services is partly subsidised by the cheaper services like the cataract, eye surgery and a host of other services that are provided. Well, if you start skimming off those lucrative, easy to perform services and handing them all over to private health providers, then what's going to happen is that particular hospital is going to lose that very important stream of income, which helps to prop up the structure that is needed to provide all those other more expensive services.
Now, it looks like you could be barking up the right tree here, because in the Daily Telegraph yesterday, we had John Appleby, who's chief economist at the King's Fund, a think tank, saying that deaths from heart attacks and cancer are falling in Britain despite lower spending on health than in countries such as France, because this is one of the main reasons that's being given, is that healthcare in Europe, we're not actually up to their standard.
Yes, I heard him on the radio this morning, actually, and he was saying that the government is being presenting a very partial picture by claiming that it's all about improving health services, because in fact, he says, if you take a year in isolation, for example 2008, which is what the government's been saying, yes, it is true that death rates from, for example, heart disease is much higher in the UK than in France. But if you look at a picture going back, say, 30 years, what you'll see is that there's been a dramatic fall in death rates from heart disease, and so much so that if current trends continue, and there's no reason why they shouldn't, we will actually overtake France, and our death rates will be lower than France by 2012. So he's saying they're not presenting a full picture. It's much more complex than that.
Now, what about on a more personal level? Have you had much dealings with the health service over the last, I suppose, 20 years or so, and seen changes?
Yes, I have, actually. Not for me personally particularly, but my father died about 12 years ago, so he died of cancer, and he had a long period of having to be treated for that, so I was very involved in that. And then in the last 3 years, my mother, well, she's actually currently in hospital right now, she's just undergone her 8th operation. She's had a succession of knee operations from falling and breaking her knee very badly, and all kinds of problems since then. So I've actually, you know, I have spent a lot of time in and out of hospital, and I must admit, I do notice the difference, the very big difference between the atmosphere that was around 12 years ago when my father, both my parents have had very good treatment. I have to say, my father's doctors were fantastic, but it was very obvious that this health service was very stretched, and that people were not very happy, and there were problems. And now, of course, there are still it's still stretched, and there are still problems. But the level of satisfaction and the kind of atmosphere among the staff and patients is quite different. And I think it's very telling that back in the late 1990s, satisfaction with the health service was 34%. In 2009, satisfaction had risen to 64%, and that is as a direct result of the investment that has been made in the health service over the last 10 years, and that includes setting up primary care trusts that are currently going to be dismantled.
What about staff morale? Have you noticed much of a difference? Because that's quite a good indicator, isn't it, of how well a system is working.
Yes, I mean, I do get the sense from my exposure to staff that things are much better now. I mean, that's only a partial view, obviously, but I think the fact that there's this nationwide survey which has backed up the fact that satisfaction all round with the health service has doubled in the last 10 years, I think that's a good indicator.
Okay, so what can we do, Susie? You know, if people feel passionately about this, what can you actually do in order to try and keep the National Health Service as it is a National Health Service?
Well, I think there are several things. I think we have to wake up to the danger that's facing us. So I think people need to get active. I think they need to contact their MPs. They need to ask them questions, serious questions about this. And they need to basically impress upon them that we absolutely want to keep our National Health Service a National Health Service. It is the most efficient and the most civilised form of health service, to be honest with you, I think. So we have to get active. In Bristol, we've set up a group of, we're just ordinary citizens who are worried about this, have set up a group that is trying to raise awareness on these issues. It's called Bristol 38 Degrees, because 38 Degrees is a national lobbying organisation, and we're just a Bristol group that have been set up. And if you would like to send an email to Bristol 38 Degrees, that's Bristol 38 Degrees at yahoogroups.com, then I would be delighted to get in touch with you and get you involved. But I would really ask people to start writing to their newspapers, write to their GPs, and make a noise, because the thing is, the National Health Service affects all of us. Sooner or later, we all encounter it, whether it's when we are born or when we die. And usually we encounter it when we are at our most vulnerable and most needy. We need it to be there for us.
Now, old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. Martin, I mean, you were here with John Rogers, and in fact, I wonder, Susie, if maybe we couldn't get you and John Rogers in one week as people from both sides of the spectrum to really thrash some of these issues out, to see what are these reforms going to mean for us, because we can't mess around with health, can we?
No.
Anyway, Martin, how can you put this into sort of the cuts context? Because we're being told that this is one of the reasons we've got to do this is because we've got to cut, and simply it's the balance sheets aren't balancing up.
Well,
how they are at the moment.
Frankly, this kind of top-down reorganisation, which David Cameron promised there was going to be no top-down reorganisations of the health service, that was his pledge to the people.
He wrote it into the coalition agreement.
But here we are having a top-down... what the Conservatives have to remember is, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And don't forget that you haven't run this past the ordinary people. This has all been smuggled in, and suddenly we're being presented with this huge revolutionary change, none of which was discussed before the election. So there's no mandate for this. And I'd just like to pick up on the point. The British National Health Service is the most efficient in the world, by far. An OECD study showed that 18 months ago. We spend far less proportion of our national wealth on health than the French do, but our outcomes are virtually identical. Which is the cheapest and most efficient system? It's our system. And in actual fact, this is not going to save any money, like many of the other reorganisations that are going on. It's actually going to increase rather than decrease the deficit. And as the new year, as this year progresses, by the end of the year, it's going to be obvious to even the dimmest people that the deficit is bigger and the economy is in a hole. And frankly, the people in charge don't know what they're doing.
Well, Susie, I'm going to give you the final word for a minute now. Do you think it's actually going to be possible to turn this policy around? Because Mr Cameron and Lansley are in charge. They've decided what they're going to do here.
Yes, I think it is possible. You know, when people mobilise and when they get active, it is possible. The health service is an iconic service for this country. And I think the only reason why we haven't had more agitation from ordinary people is that people have really not been aware of the full scale of what's happening. And people don't really understand the language of PCTs and strategic health authorities. But fundamentally, when people start to realise what's at risk, yes, of course we can turn it around.
So who's been pushing these reforms? Is it the Conservative Party or is it the private healthcare industry? And if so, how have they been doing it? Well, spinwatch.org is based at Strathclyde University in Glasgow, and they've been looking into this very question. Stand by then for what may be one of the most frightening 10 minutes of radio you've ever heard. Taking us on a health industry lobbying tour, journalist Tamsin Cave and Professor David Miller are on now. Their report begins with Dr. Jackie Davis from the Alliance for Lobbying Transparency.
What we're looking at is the most radical assault on the NHS since it began. Liberating the NHS really means unprecedented cuts, job losses, denial of accountability and privatisation. It means liberating the NHS budget to hand it over to the corporate sector. And among those companies waiting like vultures around a dying animal are those very same companies who spend $1 million a day in the States lobbying against Obama's healthcare reforms.
So this is a film about those companies that are circling the NHS, wanting a slice of that £100 billion budget. We're going to take a tour of some of their offices, some of the lobbying agencies that they hire and some of the think tanks that they pay to push their agenda with our politicians here in Parliament. And they're pretty close to getting what they want. Andrew Lansley has published a white paper called Liberating the NHS, which is going to present to Parliament at the end of January. It's been heavily criticised for opening the doors of the NHS to private, for-profit companies.
NHS care has always been provided primarily by NHS providers, that is to say NHS institutions, which are accountable to the public. So hospitals are NHS institutions. That's going to change, and it will be something called any willing provider. And any willing provider means anybody who wants to tender to deliver NHS services can put in a bid. And that, of course, in this context means the private sector. So the NHS will be competing with the private sector for every bit of NHS care that's delivered.
At the same time, another major change in the white paper is that GPs are going to be handed the lion's share of the NHS budget to buy or commission services for their population. The thing is that most GPs don't want to do it, don't have the time to do it, or the skills to do it, which means another opportunity for private healthcare companies.
So they're being encouraged by the government to give that work to private companies who are waiting to come in and take it over. Private commissioning companies, they're called. And they will hold that huge 80% of the NHS budget.
Here we are in the shadow of Parliament, outside the Westminster office of United Health UK, which is one of the companies looking to get into commissioning of services for GPs, so trying to get its hands on that NHS budget. United Health UK is part of the United Health Group, which is an enormous US health insurance company. It made profits of $4.5 billion last year, but it's coming for a lot of criticism from health campaigners in the US for accusations of malpractice and overcharging, and also the levels of executive pay that it dishes out.
A few years ago, I think the president of United Healthcare made so much money that one in every $700 that was spent in this country on healthcare went to pay him.
Yeah. There are loads of ways that companies lobby our politicians here in the UK. They employ their own lobbyists, they employ lobbying agencies, they pay think tanks, they lobby through trade associations, but crucially, they get close to our decision makers by employing political insiders. And United Health UK is no exception. Its vice president in the UK is a guy called Simon Stevens, who was a health policy advisor to Tony Blair, and really the architect behind New Labour's NHS reforms.
Lobbying is a huge industry. The offices around where we're standing now are full of lobbyists of all sorts and stripes, and they are engaged in an attempt to manage the political process. They can't do that without having contacts with people inside politics, with ministers, civil servants, MPs, members of the House of Lords, and that means of course that they want to get very close to them. So what happens often is that the people will move from working as a Labour Party researcher or as a Tory Party spin doctor into a think tank or a lobbying agency as part of their career progression. They might then move back and become an MP or a special advisor, or maybe they become a minister. And then at the end of the ministerial career, they might then move swiftly off into a sinecure with a big healthcare corporation, like, for example, Patricia Hewitt did with Boots. So you have this kind of revolving door where people move from lobbying to regulation to lobbying to regulation again, and there's a cosy culture which grows up as a result of that, where the attempt to actually change minds is not really very important, because all the minds have already been changed by this revolving door process, where they all start to think in the same way and start to believe that the corporation's interests are the only interests worth paying attention to. So you've got this culture of corruption, so institutional corruption inside the decision-making bodies of Parliament and Westminster and Whitehall.
Just up the road there is a lobbying agency that's been hired by the big five hospital companies in the UK to push their agenda with politicians, which is where we're heading now. So these are the offices of Westminster Advisors. They're a lobbying agency that's been hired by the five big private hospital companies in the UK. They formed this lobby group called H5. They too employ their own political insiders. So the guy who works on the H5 account is a former speechwriter to the Lib Dem shadow cabinet. Westminster Advisors is literally one of hundreds of lobbying agencies operating in London, most of whom within 10 minutes of Parliament. And there's another one just around the corner, which is also heavily involved in health.
Lobbying consultancies, a £2 billion industry in this country, are overwhelmingly paid for by big corporations. 80 or 90% of their clients are big corporations, and most of the money comes from the corporations. So in the healthcare sector, that's obviously going to be the corporations who are trying to make profits out of health, whether that's pharmaceuticals or providing healthcare services or any other of the associated services in the healthcare industry. This is about large corporations spending a little bit of money on lobbying, a lot of money to us, but a little bit of money for them on lobbying to make huge sums of profits at the end of the day on their balance sheets. And lobbying is a tactical investment for them so that they can make larger profits.
So these are the offices of Edelman, which is a public relations and lobbying firm. It has 55 people working in its dedicated health department, and it lobbies for, amongst others, Bupa, the health insurance company, and the pharmaceutical giants AstraZeneca and Pfizer. Just up the road is another lobbying firm that's also heavily involved in health.
The problem with lobbying as an industry is that it can overwhelm the democratic structure, and it can mean that certain interests are able to dominate by spending lots of money or by being able to populate the information environment around decision makers, so that most of what they hear is from special interests and not from citizen interests.
Just up this road here, Buckingham Gate, sits Buckingham Palace, but right next door to the Queen is a company called Quiller Consultants. Now, this is owned by Lord Chadlington, who's a close ally of David Cameron's. It lobbies for, among others, a private equity firm that's heavily invested in healthcare, but also Capita, the huge outsourcing company that's involved in the NHS. Now, it's lobbyists, so the people lobbying on behalf of these companies are also incredibly connected to the Conservative Party. So you've got a guy called George Bridges. Now, he was invited by David Cameron to run his general election campaign. You've also got the former chief of staff of Theresa May. There's an ex-strategist from the Department of Health, all pushing the agenda of these companies that hire Quilla consultants. Just down the road there, quite handily, are the offices of Capita. Here we are on Victoria Street. Parliament is just down at the end there, and at number 71 is Capita, which is a huge outsourcing company. £3.3 billion worth of government spending has gone through its books since the Tories came to power. It's given the Conservative Party £1.5 million in the last decade, and at the moment it's got its eye on running the popular telephone advice line, which is NHS Direct. Now, in August, Andrew Lansley announced that he was going to scrap NHS Direct to public outcry, and it was an idea put forward in June by a think tank whose offices are just here at number 83. This is the office of 2020 Health, they're called. And Lansley has described them as providing valuable impact on future policy, policies which include giving more NHS work to private sector companies. It's worth taking a closer look at who or what 2020 Health is. It describes itself as an independent grassroots think tank funded by people like you, for people like you. In fact, it takes a lot of money from large pharmaceutical companies, so Novartis, Pfizer, Lilly, and also companies looking to get into the telehealth market, so BT and Vodafone. And it's in a good position to influence Conservative politicians on behalf of these companies. Its chairman is a guy called Tom Sackville, who in the 90s was a former Tory health minister. He's also actually the UK CEO of an international network of private health insurers called the International Federation of Health Plans, which actually has offices in Victoria. 2020 Health founder and CEO is a woman called Julia Manning, who stood as a Tory party candidate.
So think tanks are also a core part of the lobbying business. Think tanks are thought of as being independent, cerebral activities, but actually they're really a means for lobbying. And think tanks are set up by people who have particular agendas. Usually they are funded by big business. There's a whole network of think tanks around about Parliament, mostly free market think tanks, and they themselves form into networks. So there's a network called the Stockholm Network of over 120 think tanks, and they are engaged in a whole range of lobbying activities across Europe and in the UK. The network itself was actually set up in part by Pfizer, the big American drugs company, and that's a core part of the lobbying business, is that think tanks provide this arena for debate, apparent debate and apparent research, which allows the corporate interest to push their own interest and to get on side with the minister, to have the minister to address their conference and to make sure that they can massage the information environment.
This is the Policy Exchange. It's the think tank that's the closest to Parliament, which is spitting distance that way. It's also David Cameron's favourite think tank. It was co-founded by Francis Maude, who's in the Cabinet. And it's at the moment lobbying for more private sector involvement in providing NHS services. So it wants to see private companies providing work that the public sector does at the moment. One of the companies that it's taken money from is a company called Tribal. And this is looking to get into the commissioning process, so taking over from GPs. And one of the directors of Tribal has actually described Andrew Lansley's reforms as being the denationalisation of health services in England. This is the Adam Smith Institute, which is the granddaddy of pro-business, free-market think tanks. It's a fierce critic of the NHS. It thinks that government should only regulate healthcare and it should be privately funded and privately provided, so by private sector companies. Its co-founder is a guy called Eamon Butler, who's also on the advisory board of another lobby group called Nurses for Reform, which is also a fierce critic of the NHS, has called it a Stalinist nationalised abhorrence. In a classic PR move, Nurses for Reform claims to be a grassroots organisation representing the views of ordinary nurses, but like the Adam Smith Institute, it's completely opaque about its funding.
It's very difficult to find out who funds the think tanks, because none of the think tanks are transparent about how much they're paid and for what. Some of the think tanks do list some of the corporations who give them some money, but none of them will tell you how much money they get from Pfizer or from Bupa or United Health, and they're very intransparent. And this is paralleled by the lack of transparency in the lobbying industry in general. Some of them will tell you their clients, but none of them will tell you how much money they get.
This is Hope House, home of Reform, yet another pro-business free market think tank, also set up by a Conservative minister, Nick Herbert. It too is pushing for more private company opportunities in the NHS, so more private companies providing the services that we get. Its deputy director is a guy called Nick Seddon, who prior to this was actually head of communications at a private hospital company called Circle. Now, Circle has just won the first contract for a private company to run a whole NHS hospital. And actually, the person who's replaced Nick Seddon at Circle has just come straight from Andrew Lansley's office to become their head of communications. So Reform actually supports another lobby group that claims to be a grassroots organisation called Doctors for Reform. Now, the chief spokesman of Doctors for Reform is a GP, a guy called Dr. Paul Charlton, but he also runs a private centre for cosmetic treatment, so he does Botox and things like that. Now, he's also a director of the think tank 2020 Health, just up the road, and chair of something called the Conservative Medical Society, which is affiliated with the Conservative Party. Now, Doctors Reform says it's funded by private donations, but actually Reform has taken money off a lot of private healthcare companies, so drug companies, PruHealth, the health insurer, and also the largest private hospital company in the UK called General Healthcare Group. So General Healthcare Group funded a Reform conference in 2009, at which they invited Andrew Lansley to speak, and he shared a platform with the CEO of General Healthcare Group, as well as Simon Stevens from United Health. What this film's trying to show is just a slice of the lobbying industry. So just some of the private healthcare companies, some of the lobbying agencies that they hire, some of the think tanks that they pay, all to push their agenda with our politicians here in Parliament. Most of it happens behind closed doors and without any sort of public scrutiny. The question is, are Andrew Lansley and our other politicians listening too closely to their voices and not enough to the public?
That was Tamsin Cave and Professor David Miller from spinwatch.org. Scary stuff, isn't it? Based at Strathclyde University. And I'll just give out the main website. It's just called www.keepournhspublic.com. And as Susie said, there's a local group here in Bristol with links from there if you want it. Now, the press is every day becoming more and more powerful, for good or evil. Its influence on men's minds has become so marked that it may with truth be said the press rules public opinion rather than public opinion ruling the press. That's an extract from J. Arthur Gibbs, A Cotswold Village, Believe It or Not, Country Life and Pursuits in Gloucestershire, written over a century ago, well before the age of television. When was it then that TV entertainment stopped and the infotainment began? When did we stop being educated and started to be dumbed down? Do you remember when sex and violence were portrayed with subtlety and sensitivity on our TV screens? And how about when documentaries were balanced and fair? Do you remember when the television in the corner felt like a trustworthy friend? Well, if so, you were probably watching before Thursday the 29th of January 1987, the day The Knives came out at the BBC. That's the day respected current affairs journalist and Director General Alastair Milne was sacked, to be replaced at the top by an accountant. Chairman of the BBC Board of Governors, Marmaduke Hussey, reveals in his autobiography he'd been told to sack Milne by City Banking Dynasty's ghostly agent, Victor Rothschild. In this series of investigations, we turn a critical eye on Bristol and Britain's media. Week by week, Friday Drive Time will examine the ways in which the free press we rely on to inform the big decisions in our lives has been compromised. To such an extent, it can now be used to induce fear and media panics out of nothing, even secretly waging psychological warfare on the public. Journalists that showed too much initiative when it comes to telling the truth are now routinely identified by managers and editors, singled out or smeared and then shown the door. And there's always a queue of compliant wannabe journalists waiting to fill their shoes. So to begin, we go back to that fateful day, 24 years ago tomorrow, when the lights went out in the BBC boardroom. One man that was deeply involved in making programmes that upset Victor Rothschild and other actors behind the scenes in Thatcher's government was BBC Scotland documentary producer Brian Barr. His six-part series was researched and presented by one of Britain's great investigative journalists, Duncan Campbell. Here's an extract from one documentary in the series where investigative journalist Duncan Campbell talks to former military policeman Ricky Hill.
Members of some army units have already been trained to run internment camps.
It did actually quite shock me to quite a large extent, because I've never ever realised that was the type of thing that the TA was going to be used for.
One type of internment camp was to hold suspected saboteurs. An island on the south coast had quite another role.
This was a different type of internment camp. It was more for a mass of people, not for individuals.
What kind of British people were supposedly being picked up in this exercise?
Obviously, people such as pacifists, politicos, etc., were major targets. They were people that would be singled out for special treatment.
Were you under any doubt that this was a dry run for the internment of British civilians?
Absolutely no doubt about it at all. That's what shocked me about it.
A full list of designated essential service routes is posted outside your local authority headquarters.
The first two new emergency powers bills provide for controls on transport and movement by the public at a time when many people could desperately be trying to move to areas they thought safer. The laws are intended to control not just panic, but dissent as well.
We're trying to get across to relatives in Lincolnshire.
Not this way, you're not. Essential service is only this road. You'll have to find another route, I'm afraid.
Well, that's bloody ridiculous. You can't just stop people like that.
Essential service routes include major trunk roads through almost every British city.
Secret society. The programme exposed deep-rooted corruption and dirty tricks by the Tory government of the day, as well as police chiefs acting as a law unto themselves and £1 billion accounting fraud in Britain's military procurement. Secret Society was produced by Brian Barr, and I spoke to him earlier this week about the lies, the bullying and other underhand attempts to censor one of the most hard-hitting documentaries the BBC had ever made.
My name's Brian Barr, and back in November 1987, there was a small event in Parliament which most people didn't even notice. The MP George Galloway, who happened to be my MP, asked the Lord Advocate a question in Parliament, the Lord Advocate being the senior government law officer in Scotland. And the question was, are any prosecutions going to follow on from the Zircon affair? To which the answer was, no. And as I say, most people didn't really take much notice of this little exchange in Parliament. But a couple of people did. One was the investigative journalist Duncan Campbell, and the other was me, because Duncan and I, for the previous 2 years, had been working on a series of programmes called Secret Society. And one of the six programmes in that series had caused something of a stink and had led to Duncan and myself being questioned with a view to prosecution under Section 1 of the old Official Secrets Act. And that's a section which covers espionage and carries a maximum sentence of life imprisonment. So Duncan and I were rather relieved to hear the Lord Advocate say no, there would be no prosecutions in connection with the Zircon affair, as it had become known. But to go back to the beginning of the story, a couple of years before, Duncan Campbell had approached myself and my boss and executive producer at BBC Scotland with an idea for this series, really looking into some of the darker corners of government and intelligence and defence business, revealing a few things that we knew the government would prefer, we didn't reveal, but he talked in some detail about five of the programmes that he had in mind. He was rather reluctant to go into any details about the sixth one, and it became clear a little later why. But anyway, my boss, a chap called David Martin, put this idea for the series up to BBC Two, and it was duly commissioned. So this is back in 1985. And Duncan and I started work, with me as producer and him as presenter, working on the first five stories. And we filmed away and filmed interviews and did all the things that you do to put together television programs. But in the meantime, Duncan had told me a bit more, as he had to, because I was a producer, about the sixth program, which he had said originally was to do with the government having broken a promise which it had made to Parliament a few years before, that any major projects, even secret projects, would be put before Parliament. And if they were super secret, they would be put at least to the chairman of the Public Accounts Committee, so that Parliament could, in some sense at least, scrutinise these projects. So any project costing over £250 million would have to be put through this process. And Duncan had found out from a whistleblower that a major project costing £500 million had been hidden away in the defence budget without Parliament being told. Now, what Duncan was able to tell me a little later was that his understanding was that this major project was what's called a signals intelligence satellite, a SIGINT satellite. And that's a satellite that scoops up things like radio traffic, telemetry, that sort of thing. Nowadays, it's used very often for mobile phone conversations, intercepting them. But this was in the days before mobile phones were common. So anyway, the government, according to Duncan's source, had hidden this major project for a signals intelligence satellite in the defence budget and had therefore broken the promise that it had made to Parliament a few years before. Now, we were able to do some filming around this subject, but it was all rather general filming because, of course, the key to it was this project, the signals intelligence satellite, and its very secret code name, which was Zircon. So there had to come a point when we'd have to interview somebody that we knew would know about the Zircon project, and that included only a very few people from the Prime Minister and the Minister of Defence and one or two people at British Aerospace who were building the satellite. And we knew it was going to be quite difficult to find anybody who knew about the Zircon project. The person we got to interview was Professor Sir Ronald Mason, who had been the chief scientific advisor to the government at the time the Zircon project happened. So we arranged to interview Sir Ronald without, I have to say, telling him exactly what we were going to ask him, but rather more in general terms. Now, before we went to interview him, we realised that immediately Duncan Campbell asked him a question about the Zircon satellite, the cat, so to speak, would be out of the bag, and there might be quite serious consequences for us and for the BBC. So before we went to do the interview, we had to do a little bit of housekeeping in the offices that we shared in the BBC building in Glasgow. We had to go through all our files and so on and make sure that nothing incriminating was lying around. And having done that, we set off to interview Sir Ronald. The other thing we had to do in preparation, this was in the days of film, before videotape. And film rolls for television came in 10-minute rolls. And those of us who had had some experience of working with film had stories to tell of wonderful answers being interrupted by the cameraman saying, "Sorry, out of film, have to change the roll." So we obviously had to plan the interview quite carefully so that we decided that the general questions, which were about Britain's dependence on the United States for signals intelligence hardware, because we didn't have our own signals intelligence satellite, the Americans had several. So general questions about signals intelligence and our dependence on the Americans would take up the first role, and immediately after we changed roles, Duncan would then ask a question about Zircon, which he duly did. Now, before the interview, we'd thought about what Sir Ronald might say in answer to this. He could have said to us, "Never heard of it, never heard of Zircon, don't know what you're talking about." Or he might have said, "Zircon? Oh no, that's got nothing to do with signals intelligence." We didn't know exactly what his answer was going to be. In the event, when Duncan asked the question, "What difference will the Zircon project make to this situation between Britain and the United States?" I've never seen anybody's jaw literally drop before, but Sir Ronald's jaw dropped. Now, I thought at the time it must have been for 30 seconds he was silent. In fact, it was more like 10 seconds. But that's a long time when there's a camera pointed at you. And then Sir Ronald said, very quietly, "I'm so sorry, I can't talk to you about that." And Duncan said, "Oh, is everything about Zircon classified?" And he said, "Yes, I'm so sorry." Which was the confirmation we needed that we were on the right lines and that Zircon was indeed this signals intelligence satellite project which the government had failed to notify Parliament of. The other thing we'd had to do was say to the film crew, "Listen, immediately this interview's over, pack your gear away as quickly as possible and let's all get out of there." So we kind of knew, having mentioned the word Zircon to him and made it clear that we knew what the Zircon project was, that immediately we left, he would be making a phone call to the government and to the intelligence services saying, oops, Campbell knows about Zircon. So we were kind of expecting something very dramatic to happen straight away, and nothing very much did. The BBC was notified by the government that Duncan Campbell's series called The Secret Society included something which was a very secret project, and the government were most unhappy. So a little while later, the BBC announced that it would not be transmitting the programme about Zircon, because they said, completely wrongly, but they said, in the interest of national security. So when Duncan heard that the programme wasn't going to be transmitted, he said, right, well, in that case, he of course, wrote, and Cajun Steel writes, I think, for the New Statesman magazine. So he said, right, I'm going to tell the whole story in the New Statesman. The government rushed to get an injunction to prevent publication, but it was too late. The magazine was already on the streets. And in any case, the government law officer had forgotten that a High Court injunction taken out in London does not apply to Scotland. So even if they had got the injunction, readers in Scotland would have been able to read all about the Zircon affair. And then a whole series of events started to happen. The first thing was, and I have no idea how this happened, but somehow a bootleg copy of the programme got out of the BBC and started being copied time after time, and showings of the programme appeared all over the place in town halls and trade union halls, and civil liberties organisations organised showings, and even the showing in Parliament. In fact, some unkind people said, we've probably got a bigger audience for our programme through these illicit showings than we ever would have got on BBC Two. Not true, of course, but I could see the point that they were trying to make. So everything got really rather hectic at that point. And the New Statesman offices were then raided by the Special Branch, obviously looking for the source of the information, the whistleblower who had told Duncan Campbell about this. And the next thing that happened is a Special Branch raid on Duncan's own house. Duncan actually got a phone call, he doesn't know who it's from, simply saying, the Special Branch will be outside your house in about an hour, which gave Duncan time to phone his contacts in newspapers and television and say, you might want to get yourselves round to Stoke Newington, because I think there's going to be a bit of action there. And Duncan then went to his front door, locked it from the inside, went out of the back door, climbed over a neighbour's fence, and walked up to Stoke Newington Church Street nearby, and hung about there until he saw the police cars arrive, at which point Duncan sauntered up. The Special Branch inspector who was in charge of the raid showed him the warrant, and Duncan said, well, now that all seems to be in order. Put his key in the lock, and of course it wouldn't open. He tried several times and apologised profusely to the policeman, said, I don't seem to be able to open my front door. Do you want to have a try? So the policeman tried, and he couldn't open it either. And the policeman said, well, sorry, Mr. Campbell, what are you going to do? You'll be wanting to get into your own house. And Duncan said, well, you have to try and push down the door. And the officer said, well, would it be helpful if I asked a couple of my officers to do that for you? And Duncan said, actually, I would appreciate that very much. Now, bear in mind, the press were there, television cameras were there, as two burly Special Branch officers put their shoulders to Duncan Campbell's front door and burst it open. And that film of the Special Branch raiding the dissident journalist and bashing down his front door went all around the world. And I have to say, that's the kind of thing I might have thought of about 3 months later, but I was most impressed by the fact that Duncan immediately thought that that would be the best plan. And things then quietened down again for a week or two, but we were kind of half expecting that something might happen up at the BBC headquarters in Glasgow. And sure enough, on a Saturday morning, when I was actually just about to go out and watch my son playing football, I got a phone call from our executive producer, David Martin, saying the Special Branch have just arrived at the BBC headquarters in Glasgow, and could you get yourself in here as quickly as possible? Which I did, and spent the rest of that day watching a large group of special branch officers cleaning out the offices that we'd worked in, not just the Zircon material, but everything to do with the entire series, notebooks, files, films, audio tapes, the lot. By the end of the day, our offices were left with simply the furniture and nothing else. And then the questioning started. Both Duncan and I were questioned twice each by a special branch. Obviously, what they wanted to know was the name of the whistleblower, the source of Duncan's information. Needless to say, we didn't give them. It was the usual good cop, bad cop routine, with the bad cop saying, "You do realise, guys, you're facing life imprisonment. Make it easy on yourselves and cooperate, and we might have a wee word with the judge who might go easy on you." They have terrible scriptwriters, the police. It really is it's rather sad that they don't come out with better lines than the old clichés. But anyway, that was us being questioned under Section 1 of the Official Secrets Act, the section that covers espionage. And then things went quiet, and of course Duncan Campbell and I were left with... We'd almost finished all editing all six of the programmes at the time of this raid. So we were left with no material and actually nothing very much to do. So we, at that point, went our separate ways. I moved down to the BBC in Manchester, and Duncan moved back to continue working for the New Statesman. And that was the Zircon affair until, as I say, in November 1987, when the Lord Advocate finally announced that we were not, after all, going to spend the rest of our lives in prison. But to be honest, neither Duncan nor I thought that that was very likely, that the government would pursue any kind of criminal action against us, mainly because the programme had not been about revealing the existence of Britain's first signals intelligence satellite. It had been about the government deceiving Parliament, and the last thing the government wanted to do was have all of that aired in court. So that was the Zircon affair. The thing that astounds me, looking back over this, is to realise it's 25 years ago, and most of your listeners, I suspect, will never have heard of the Zircon affair.
There was the accusations against you of threatening national security. Now, clearly, if there's a secret spy satellite and you're making a programme about it, then it's not secret anymore, is it?
No, it's not, but these satellites are not secret. These are very large satellites. They have huge antennae that scoop up all these radio signals, and anybody who knows anything about satellites can instantly tell that that's not a communication satellite, it's a signals intelligence satellite. The Soviet Union, as it then was, would have known within minutes, if not seconds, after the satellite went up, that that's exactly what it was. It was also going to be identical to about 10 or 12 similar satellites that the Americans had, and which the Soviet Union, who were then notionally our enemies, knew all about. So the secrecy was in fact not about the satellite itself or what it could do, because that was well known in these circles. It was about deception, that the government deceived Parliament and didn't put this project through its proper procedures.
Now, did all of the six programmes eventually get aired?
No, four of them were finally aired on BBC Two. The Zircon programme finally appeared on a late-night programme, which was mainly a studio-based discussion programme about censorship and the media. And a re-edited version of the Zircon programme then went out, but you had to be a bit of a night owl to see it. And of course, by then, most people who were interested in the whole matter had already seen the programme at one of the many, many illicit showings that had gone on all around the country.
And what about the final one of the six?
Final one, the BBC withheld because they said it was to do with cabinet committees. And the BBC withheld it because they said there was an election looming. What it revealed was that some cabinet committees under the Thatcher government had been orchestrating action against some completely legal and legitimate organisations like CND. I mean, I think in this case the BBC might have had a case in that, because of all the delays caused by the special branch taking away the programmes and so on, by the time we got the material back, it was indeed getting quite close to an election, and although the points that we were making in the programme would have applied to any government of whatever party, the fact was that it would have been a tricky programme to put out just before an election, because it showed the Thatcher government in a very poor light. And it was eventually aired, a re-edited, recut version of it was eventually shown on Channel 4 television, but this was a long time afterwards.
Now, the other programmes, another one was on data protection. What was that about?
That was mainly about, this all seems terribly old hat now, but remember, this was 25 years ago.
Maybe it was a bit ahead of its time.
Well, maybe it was a bit ahead of its time. That would be a nice way of putting it, yes. It was about all the information that is held about us on various things like credit, reference agency, computers and so on, that people at that time had no idea about. People had no idea that the electoral rolls was the basis for these huge computer databases that contained information about us. What we actually did was we set up a computer terminal in a market town in Yorkshire and invited people to come in and have a look and see what was held in file about them, which actually, as a way of explaining what was going on, was really worked rather well, because people were just astounded to see all the information that was held about them on computer systems. I think now people will be equally shocked, not about things like credit reference agencies, which was what we were mainly looking at, but about all the other stuff that various databases hold on them. So yes, maybe it was a little bit ahead of its time.
Another programme was about emergency planning. You know, this is one thing, you know, we try and put out of our mind what would happen in a time of war or other serious crisis.
People weren't aware of the amount of planning and preparation that had been done in the event of nuclear war. It was just looking at the various things that the government planned to do and how vulnerable people would be left under the government's plans.
Another one was called A Gap in Our Defences, and which is looking at botched radar projects and this kind of thing.
Yes, Britain had a number of radar systems since the Second World War, most of which had failed utterly to do what they were supposed to do. I mean, all of these, practically, or several of these programmes, were about the way the Ministry of Defence's procurement programmes go badly wrong. Because, I mean, in the case of Zircon, going back to Zircon, it was finally abandoned because the cost had doubled from $500 million to £1 billion. And you think, I think I've heard that story since, of the Ministry of Defence budget being blown by ridiculously bad procurement arrangements. It's a story that's been going on for at least 25 years, and I suspect longer than that. And the radar programme was another example of that.
The final programme was about the Association of Chief Police Officers, which has been in the news recently, running these very questionable surveillance exercises against environmental protesters. So what was the focus of your ACPO programme?
Well, ACPO at that time was not at all well known. Most people had never heard of ACPO, and certainly had no idea that ACPO, the two ACPOs, the England and Wales one and the Scottish one, lay down policies for the police and are completely unaccountable. They can make up the rules, provided it's within the law. And at that time, ACPO's powers were not at all known to members of the public. And it was simply revealing not only what their powers were, but how unaccountable ACPO were then and still are now.
The climate of the time, I think, was quite an interesting one, towards the end of the Thatcher era, the 80s. For many people now, they've really no idea what things were like back then.
Well, Mrs. Thatcher had already shown that she was very fierce when it came to people embarrassing her government. You remember the Spycatcher case and cases like that, where the full panoply of the law and the intelligence services were devoted to preventing embarrassment to the government. In most cases, nothing to do with national security. Nothing was being revealed that would undermine national security. But she was very keen on not having the government be embarrassed, particularly by annoying investigative journalists like, well, Duncan Campbell, mainly in this case. It was actually one of our proudest moments when Mrs. Thatcher said in Parliament when asked about the whole Zircon affair that she regarded us as, I think the phrase was, rats gnawing at the very foundations of good government. And, I mean, if you want a campaign medal, I don't think you get a better campaign medal than that.
Now, all this is really to do with a kind of power struggle, in a way, over information between the government and the media. In those days, it was the BBC. How do you think that struggle is going today?
I don't think a great deal of progress has been made. I mean, the Freedom of Information Act has made some difference, but there are so many exceptions to that and so many ways to prevent people getting information that they're entitled to, that it's not worked nearly as well as those of us who campaigned for a Freedom of Information Act would have liked to see. So I think the balance hasn't shifted in the United Kingdom in the way it, for example, has done in the United States, where the government, I mean, leaving aside WikiLeaks for the moment, the US government has always been more accountable to the press and the public than British governments have been. There may be many things wrong with the United States, but that's one of the things that they have got a lot more right than we ever have.
Do you think it would be possible to make a series like Secret Society today at the BBC?
No. No, the BBC would run a mile. I mean, the amount of opposition that we had from senior management at the BBC in London was, even then, was astounding. I mean, we were amazed at the lack of support, although this had been a properly commissioned series of programmes. I mean, there was one person that I might mention, a chap called Alan Protheroe, who was Assistant Director General of the BBC at the time, and he took a great interest in the whole Secret Society and particularly the Zircon programme. And he kept coming to meetings about it, saying he had spoken to the Ministry of Defence, and the Ministry of Defence, they stuck to their cover story, which I should perhaps have mentioned earlier. The Ministry of Defence said that this new satellite was actually part of a system called Skynet, which was a military communication satellite system intended so that the UK could be in touch with its NATO allies. Now, Ministry of Defence announced that this new satellite was the third satellite in the Skynet series. But unfortunately, British Aerospace had put out a press release saying that this new satellite was going to be positioned over the Indian Ocean, which is a very good place to listen in to the Soviet Union. But when you think about it, it's not a good place to put a satellite if you're wanting to communicate with your North Atlantic Treaty Organization partners, which is what the Ministry of Defence story was. So Alan Protheroe, this Assistant Director General, kept coming to these meetings and saying, no, 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 I've been told Zircon's nothing to do with signals intelligence. And we would say, well, yeah, but here's the evidence that that's all it can be. And it was only later that we found out that Assistant Director General Alan Protheroe should probably have been called Lieutenant Colonel Alan Protheroe, because he was actually a Lieutenant Colonel in the Territorial Army. So no doubt he had very good contacts in the Ministry of Defence. And this kind of opposition, and there was a woman called Daphne Park, who was on the board of governors of the BBC, who was highly critical of the then Director General, Alistair Milne, for even thinking of commissioning a series with Duncan Campbell as presenter. Now, Daphne Park was a former MI5 officer. So, you know, even within the BBC, there was a lot of opposition at the highest levels to what we were doing. Now, if anybody came along with an idea like this, I think they would just be shown the door. There's no chance at all it would be commissioned.
Not long after the series was made, the Director General, Alistair Milne, was sacked. Do you think you and your colleagues and Duncan Campbell played a part in that?
Alistair Milne's autobiography makes it absolutely clear that he thought then and thinks still that the main reason he was sacked was to do with the Secret Society series. And I have to say, although Alistair Milne was the one who decided that Zircon would not be shown, most of us programme makers were really sorry to see him go, because he had been, I think, a very good Director General and particularly supportive of programme makers. But yes, he paid the price for Secret Society, and I think he was a loss to the BBC.
Brian Barr there, producer of the 1987 series Secret Society, which, through the machinations of Lord Victor Rothschild of MI5 and banking dynasty fame, got fearless BBC Director General Alistair Milne sacked. And it all happened 24 years ago tomorrow. Now, Martin Summers is joining me again. Martin, it's a little bit strange, isn't it, to have military officers and former MI5 officers actually running the BBC?
Well, the BBC has always had this element of state direction in its operations. I think we need both government-funded and non-government-funded media if we're going to have a check and a balance there. The BBC needs to be independent of government, but clearly most of the time it isn't.
I mean, I wonder what the situation might be now. I mean, obviously, these people aren't wearing their military uniforms when they're sitting around the BBC Trust or when they're sitting around with the governors at the BBC.
Well, that's right. And I think when it comes to covering stories about terrorism, for example, there's an awful lot of manipulation of public opinion going on. And we look to public service broadcasters to tell us, you know, the unvarnished truth about these things. And how far can we trust them to do that?
Good question. Right. Well, we'll be having more on censorship next week when we look at MI5 smearing journalists and getting them sacked at the BBC in the Christmas tree files. Now, Guardian security correspondent Richard Norton Taylor discovered MI5 had stamped a green Christmas tree with a little rubber stamp on the personnel files of all BBC staff they wanted sacked. And down the River Thames, that is, at MI6, where millions of our taxes every year go on what is called Information Operations, or IOPS, running journalists as agents of influence in the various newspapers and broadcasters in London, and planting MI6 stories in the national press. And we ask, is it right for the security services to have a spy in every British newsroom? Well, that's all for this week. Coming up next is the Sky News at 7 o'clock. Thanks very much to our guests in the first hour. That was Labour Councillor for Southmead, Jenny Smith, also to reporter Marina Morris, and to former Women's Editor of the Western Daily Press, Susie Weldon, who came in to talk about the NHS. And that website she mentioned was www.keepournhspublic.com. And, of course, to our resident old Labour economist, Martin Summers. If you're on broadband internet, you can hear all our previous Friday drive times, including this programme's 5-point economic recovery plan, a report on mobile phone masks and wireless safety, evidence of Masonic corruption in the police, in Dorset particularly, an extended interview with managing editor of BBC Radio Bristol, Tim Pemberton, an investigation into leadership charity Common Purpose, and many more. Just go to thisweek.org.uk and click on the link to our archives. A podcast of this show is usually online by midnight after broadcast. That's enough talk for tonight, because Friday night is music night. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. See you next week.
BC FM 93.2 FM. It is your voice and it is your choice.
BC FM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody